sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Just this.
Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Criticism.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Focus.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
Responsibility.
In the border, I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and my special guest today is Brian Banks, former director of the Saskatchewan office of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for the invitation.
And we're going to be talking about, I think something near and dear to everyone's hearts, money. And I used to work for a fellow in a sales office, and he had a little sign up on his office wall: "The lack of money is the root of all evil." And from the sales perspective, I guess that was true. Yeah. But before we get going on our discussion, I just wanted to touch on the Look and Listen lottery. We're getting down to the final few days here for the CJTR 2014 Look and Listen Lottery, Summer in the City, and the grand prize, a trip for two to New York City, is up for grabs here, and that consists of a return airfare for two in a four-star hotel for three nights. You get Mets or Yankees baseball tickets, tickets for a motor coach tour of Manhattan and tour of Radio City Music Hall, and $1,000 cash to spend any way you want. The second prize is a $1,000 travel voucher from Carlson Wagenlee Record Travel. The third prize is a relaxing getaway at Moose Jaw's Temple Gardens Mineral Spa, which consists of a two-night stay, breakfast and dinner at Harwood's Dining Room, and a $100 gaming credit at casinos Regina and Moose Jaw. Now, these tickets are only $20 each. We're only selling 1,200 of them, and of course, there's far fewer than 1,200 left now. So if you want your ticket, you better get on it. Our draw date is May the 8th, so that's very close. You can get your tickets here at CJTR at 1102 8th Avenue, or you can call us at 525-7274 during regular office hours, Monday through Friday. And you can use your credit card, and you can also order tickets at lookandlistenlottery@cjtr.ca.
or you can just call the station. We'll tell you all about it. For more information about the rules of play or prizes, just go to www.cjtr.ca. And you can also get tickets from any programmer. They'll be happy to sell you a ticket. So we're excited about that. And we've had a couple of people. This, I think, the third time, Brian, that we've had this prize. And people are always excited about it, and that's why we're sort of continuing with a trip for two to New York City. And of course, the main reason we do this is so that we can do this. You know, here we are, and we're able to discuss some important and interesting issues that involve the community. And in addition to that, we get all sorts of different music. You never know what you're going to hear on CJTR, and that's for sure. And which is just the opposite with. Now, our friends at commercial radio, you know what you're going to get when you turn that dial on.
Absolutely, yes.
But you don't know what you're going to get at CJTR, except it's going to be fun, for sure. But anyway, the reason that I gave you a call and asked you, and thank you very much for accepting the invitation to be here, you're one of the authors of a study called A Living Wage for Regina. And... that is a study that was... Now, what happens there? Is that basically commissioned by... who decides who's going to be doing a study like this?
This study came out of similar studies in other CCPA offices, in particular the British Columbia office, where they had created a methodology to calculate a living wage. Hmm. And so the Saskatchewan office decided that they would like to do a similar study. And Simon Enoch, the director, then put together a proposal and went forth and found some funding and recruited Paul Gingrich, former professor at the University of Regina here, a statistician, and myself. And so the three of us worked on this study over probably 6 or 8 months, mm-hmm. and just released it in February 2014.
Okay, let's back up here a little bit, Brian. When we started down this trail, I was sort of aware of the Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives, but when I started looking at it, I was surprised to see just how much it does. And I'm just wondering how the whole thing started. Like, where did the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives get its start, and whose brainchild was it, and what sort of happened along the way?
It began kind of much more before my time mm-hmm. in CCPA. I became involved in CCPA in 2007 in Saskatchewan here. The original organization began in 1992.
Wow.
In Ontario, where a number of what the media calls left-leaning
okay.
academics got together and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
Their first approach was to develop an alternative federal budget, and that was a big project that they did year after year to show that there were alternatives to the present tax system, the present... you know, trade regime,
mm-hmm.
Et cetera, et cetera. And so they, every year in, I'm not sure if it occurred every year, but mm-hmm. it would generally, the alternative federal budget would come out in January, February. And through that, they structured a board, they went forth and gathered individual memberships. It's a membership-based organization.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on membership contributions.
Mm-hmm.
There are associate members and individual members. There's offices in five provinces now. And more recently, since the Great Recession,
mm-hmm.
it really has expanded its operations and its presence and the number of studies that it does. in the national office and in the provincial offices.
Mm-hmm. Which university was it centered on? A particular university in Ontario, or
I guess it was. Its original location was Ottawa because they wanted to be where the federal government presence was, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure Carleton and the University of Ottawa folks were quite strongly involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the U of T people as well.
It must have grabbed people's imagination, though, because from that sort of beginning, it's really grown a lot.
It has been successful. I think its annual budget now is over $5 million per year.
Wow!
It does a regular monthly newsletter, as well as these studies, which are all posted on www.policyalternatives.ca. They've branched out now into income distribution issues, trade. Was very strong for a while when we were in that free trade mode. The issues have become more important as inequality has grown in Canadian society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I had one question about the funding. I've noticed in the description of the organization that CCPA is a registered nonprofit. So
yes.
You can actually get a tax receipt?
Yes, you can. Absolutely. I think a $100 contribution gives you a $60 tax receipt.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And I find that kind of interesting because to me that means you must couch your reports fairly carefully so that the folks in Ottawa don't get too annoyed with you.
That's correct because you must maintain nonpartisan approach. And in fact, in 2013, the federal government did a total review of the activities of CCPA around this whole issue.
Right.
And it required a great deal of work to assemble all the financial records and all the documents and meetings and so on to convince the...
But ultimately you convinced them that you were nonpartisan.
I think that that's correct. I shouldn't speak for the national office because I don't know that. I know at one time our status was still pending.
Oh, okay, okay. Because we certainly know that... that they can be a little prickly when it comes to that sort of thing. And that's one of the things, of course, that you avoid if you're strictly member based and you're not, like, I'm pretty sure, like with Amnesty, we have the same status and we have to be just as careful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For sure. And, You have to avoid anything that they can construe as political activity.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and it gets interesting, doesn't it? Okay. Well, let's have a look at the report itself, A Living Wage for Regina. Now, you were saying that your report was based on some work that was done originally at UBC?
At CCPA BC office. I believe that the methodology was prepared by a UBC economist and then adapted by us in Saskatchewan for the Saskatchewan circumstances.
Right, right. So what were you basically trying to accomplish then with the report itself?
Well, we were concerned about the gap between the rate of inflation and wage increases over time in Regina. It's constantly reported that inflation is around 2% annually, sometimes even less, sometimes slightly more. But when we looked at the price of goods and services, particularly things like gasoline, apartment rents, condo rents, the cost of housing, tuition, the cost of water from the city. All of those things seem to be higher than 2%. And so when we talk to people and we compared their lived experience mm-hmm. with this 2% inflation, we're saying, well, what does it really take for people to have a, you know, a decent standard of living?
Mm-hmm.
We know that occupational wage rates in the industrial sector have been a bit better than 2%, but, you know, it starts to look like that we're gradually becoming a low-wage economy as more and more of jobs are created in the service sector
mm-hmm.
Of the economy. And I think this is also, the case with Regina. So we really wanted to, you know, get some answers to that. What did people, a family, really have to earn,
right,
you know, to have a decent standard of living? And so the model for this study sets up a family of four.
Mm-hmm.
Both are full-time wage earners with two children, one children in elementary school, one child not in school. So that brings into play then, you know, the cost of childcare.
Mm-hmm.
So we also thought a bit about the whole discussion of minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a lot of focus on minimum wage and sort of pressure continually in different jurisdictions to increase the minimum wage, you know, sometimes with a bit of success, other times not so. The minimum wage has been studied a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
The questions of how high it should be, does it destroy jobs, does it push other wages upward that makes it unaffordable for businesses, and so on. So we didn't want to do another minimum wage study. We mm-hmm. wanted to look at a living wage for a family of four.
Mm-hmm.
We started out kind of with the general definition of what the living wage is,
mm-hmm.
and we took from the literature the definition that it is the hourly wage rate at which a household can meet its basic needs once government transfers have been added to the family's employment income.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of programs
sure.
where there's supplements to family income. And then subtracting, though, the tax deductions. Okay, so mm-hmm. that gives us a total.
So you're basically taking everything into account then that your family four is going to be facing
right.
financially, tax time at the end of
right.
the year, and were you including say retirement savings, that type of thing?
No, that is one thing that we did not include in it. We included shelter, of course,
mm-hmm.
child care,
right.
food, household expenditures, transportation.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very small amount for transportation, $480 a month
mm-hmm.
for a family of four to
right.
to get around, and so that's
so. Like, does your family of four have a car?
Yeah, okay. They could have a car, but
okay.
they have an older car then,
yes,
right, and they're not making a very big payment,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
Because with gasoline, it's $70 a fill up. Like $480 doesn't go very far, does it?
Right.
We have clothing, less than $200 a month, healthcare, extra healthcare, and parents' education. We put it in $100 a month for parents to spend in a year,
mm-hmm.
Or in a month, I mean,
okay.
in a month, So that would be like equivalent to two classes at SIAS. So
they're upgrading.
They could upgrade, right? Mm. That's why we put that in there.
Right.
And then the contingency, we have a contingency of $192 a month. Mm-hmm. Now that's where the savings comes in,
okay.
But that's not savings for...
So would you call that sort of discretionary
their
spending?
Pension. Yes.
Okay, so...
For the crises that occur in every family's life.
Right.
Where they have to...
So that would be separate from, say, entertainment? Was entertainment a cost that was...
I think the entertainment piece kind of fell under household and that contingency thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know that, you know, there are many holidays in a year, and if you have a family, there's extra costs there. But that was getting into some details that were really hard to put a number on.
Right. And you mentioned, too, that one of the kids that they have is not school age. So you've got, and both parents are working.
Right.
So you've got daycare. Would they qualify with the money that they're making with this living wage? Would they qualify for a subsidy or not?
That's a question that Paul could answer.
Oh, okay.
I think not.
Yeah, I know.
I think that the federal subsidy they would qualify for,
mm-hmm.
But not the provincial one for a licensed daycare.
Right.
But I'm on a little bit of iffy ground there,
okay.
Jim, on that one.
Yeah. I know a few years ago, and this is probably in the neighborhood of at least five or more years ago, subsidized daycare was going to run about $500 per child. And
yes.
If you didn't have subsidy, it was going to be more like $700.
Yes.
And I have a feeling it's more than that now.
Yes.
So it's a tough world to be.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like our monthly budget shows that 26% of the budget would go to shelter and 19% would go to childcare,
mm-hmm.
because the 7-year-old would also require some after school care.
Right.
And in the summer months, the 7-year-old would have to find some daycare, right? So that starts to mount up, right?
Sure, yeah.
So as a lot of the anti-poverty people have said for years, you know, there's some areas where we can do some work to help low-income people, and that mm-hmm. is in household policy,
right?
You know, and early childhood learning, early childhood systems, daycare systems, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And in Regina, it sure shows that those two things are a big pinch on low-income people.
I'm just curious, back to the kids, do the kids participate much in sports or things like that that cost a few dollars? Is that part of the household budget, or are they just going to have to get their hockey stick and ball and go out in the street?
That's another tough one.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, it kind of fits sort of with entertainment, recreation, etc. for the family.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's expenditures there, and as you move up into certain of these sports, the fees are again considerable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this family is covering basic needs.
Right. Yeah, so
this budget is basic
needs.
This
is pretty tight stuff.
Mm-hmm,
and of
is.
Course, a lot of sports do make allowances for families that don't have a lot of money, and they can get reduced fees, I think, in some cases. And there are some organizations that will subsidize kids in some sports. So
mm-hmm.
some of that is taken care of, but it's a tough go,
mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
sure. I'm just curious about the level. I guess if both the members, both the parents, are making this living wage, I'm presuming then that they've got a ways to go as far as upgrading is concerned. They're likely not university educated, for example. Although these days that's not necessarily true.
We didn't try to do any demographic
mm-hmm.
characteristics of them. We just thought that in today's world, the need to upskill is always there. It wouldn't matter really what their level of education was. They're probably, it's a good idea to spend $1,200 a year on increasing your skills.
Yeah, for sure. Well, believe it or not, we have come to the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
And so we're going to take a break here right now. And I asked you to pick some music. And what music did you pick for me, Ryan?
Oh, I picked Mark Knopfler's Punish the Monkey.
Punish the Monkey. Okay, so we're going to hear Punish the Monkey here after the break, and then we'll continue our discussion.
Quiet as a church mouse and checking on your rights. The bus has hung you out to dry, and it looks as though we'll punish the monkey, let the organ grinder go. Let the organ grinder go.
And that was Mark Knopfler, Punish the Monkey, and I wasn't familiar with who Mark was, and Brian tells me that he's from Dire Straits, and when you listen to the music, you definitely can tell, you can hear the Dire Straits stuff in there for sure. Well, we're going to talk some more now about the study, and just looking at the executive summary here, and there's a few discussions, and in one of them, they define what the living wage is and how it differs from both the minimum wage and the average wage. So the living wage is the hourly wage rate at which a household can meet its basic needs once government transfers have been added to the family's employment income, tax deductions have been subtracted. And so this is the one that...
Once we figured out the bare bones monthly budget, mm-hmm. you know, then we used the formula, right? Expenses. What is the employment income required to meet mm-hmm. those expenses, right?
Right.
So come back from that. So we figured that out was $58,200.
Wow.
For this family of four, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you calculate that to what is the hourly wage that each must earn, then right. the living wage for Regina then is $16.46 per hour.
Right.
In order for them to earn $58,245 annually.
Right.
And so then when you start to compare that to what other people earn, for example, if you're on social assistance, you probably earn about $24,000 a family. What you need to meet the low income threshold is $33,700, and if two people were earning a minimum wage, the $10 an hour, mm-hmm. you would only earn $34,600 a year, and you would be a $24,000 under
right.
the living wage.
Right. Right. And so that, and there are families in the city that's where they are.
Absolutely, because we did a distribution of family income in Regina. Mm-hmm. 3% of families in Regina earn under $30,000. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they're under the low income threshold.
Right.
20% earn between $30,000 and $60,000. So we have a range of 23-24%. Of families in Regina then that are earning less than the living wage. It amounts to, I think, 13,000 families in Regina would have a significant improvement in their life mm-hmm. Style if they were able to earn the living wage.
And I suppose, you know, if you're not making that, you're going to be availing yourself of resources like the food bank because you have to.
Well, certainly that 3% that are earning under $30,000, mm-hmm. One would think that would be a necessity.
Right, right. I'm just wondering, Brian, what's your sense of how your study was accepted by the folks in government, municipal government, provincial government? Did they have any opinions or statements?
Well, I guess that kind of leads us into, you know, once the study was done, mm-hmm. how are we going to distribute the findings, raise awareness about the issue, and so forth?
I guess we're still at the discussion stage here too, because when was this released?
Only in February.
Yeah, so that's a long. That's not that long ago
in
terms of government. Yeah.
There's been like the current director of CCPA Saskatchewan is mm-hmm. currently doing quite a number of presentations to interested parties. Mm-hmm. It seems that the way the living wage has got off the ground in other jurisdictions is you do the calculation, get groups interested, and then try to launch a campaign so that businesses would say, okay, we voluntarily will adopt the living wage. And, for example, in British Columbia, the Canadian Cancer Society, Van City Credit Unions have got onto the campaign, and they are a living wage employer. In other words, nobody in their operation will earn less than a living wage. Wow. So that's one way of doing it, right? The second way is convincing the municipal level of government to pass an ordinance, pass a bylaw, saying that for all of the contracting that we do with employers, when they bid on a tender, they better be bidding that the wage level to meet the living wage in Regina, for example, the $16.46.
Right.
And so some municipalities have passed these bylaws. In fact, in the United States, 140 of them have.
Wow.
I think a lot of them are in the Pacific Northwest, but some of the bigger cities have done this too. Baltimore, Boston, Santa Fe. So some of the bigger cities have done this because the minimum wage in the U.S. is pitifully low. Like the federal minimum wage is it $7 an hour?
I'm not sure, but the federal government
minimum wage is very, very low. So I think this is partly why the living wage has had more momentum in the U.S.
The thing is, I guess part of it would be, like we were talking about before, it's awareness. If we can make people aware that if you're paying a minimum wage, or not a minimum wage, but a living wage, and they've got more, these families have more money to spend, it's just going to go straight back into the economy.
Yes, exactly.
And the economy will be much more prosperous.
Our study did try to provide evidence for the benefits of the living wage. I think the benefits for individual workers is pretty obvious, but sometimes we forget about some of the spin-off effects. André Picard, a regular columnist for the Globe and Mail, reported that there is a study which estimates that if those in the bottom 20% of income earned, if their income was raised one step higher on the income ladder, the savings to the health system would be $7.6 billion a year.
Wow.
That's all across. That's a Canada-wide study.
Sure.
So there are certain knockoff effects like this that people don't normally visualize that as being beneficial.
Like we'd basically all benefit.
Yes, exactly. And for businesses, there's been studies to show that if wage levels are better, productivity is higher, attendance is better, absenteeism is less. There's been studies, the Barclays Bank in the United Kingdom did a study that showed that those effects. The turnover rate in the Barclays study, turnover fell from 30% to 4%.
Wow. Now that is significant.
It is. A lot of cost savings there.
You're not retraining people because you don't have the same turnover.
Right. And all of the recruitment costs and so forth.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Costco in the United States is known to be a high wage employee. They, when they hire employees, they give them consistent increases in their salary of sometimes just small amounts, mm-hmm. but they do it regularly,
right.
and they've created a great deal of employer loyalty as a result of that policy. Their CEO, Craig Jelinek, says that paying employees good wages makes good sense for business. Instead of minimizing wages, we know it's a lot more profitable in the long term to minimize employee turnover and maximize employee productivity, commitment, and loyalty.
I think that particular CEO has paid himself a very reasonable wage compared to everybody else as well.
I think so.
I'm not sure what it is, but I know that...
It's probably like 10 times, you know, as opposed to 200 times, you know, the average wage or something. Yeah,
yeah, I think he's got something going there.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think that's the basic thing that that employers and business people should pick up on here is that if they pay people this living wage, then there is more money in the economy. They're going to spend it.
But particularly the local economy and the people who are on a basic budget like this, pretty much every cent that they earn is turned over in the local economy.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen that in Regina, you know, with the growth spurt that we've had since 2006.
Mm-hmm.
That there are a lot more opportunities for small businesses as, you know, wages have increased over this time.
Mm-hmm.
There is a bigger workforce in Regina as a result of this expansion that's happened.
Yeah.
We have the, you know, there's 25% of our folks not earning a living wage.
Right, right.
So that gets us to the inequality issue, you know, the distribution issue, and governments have been sort of weak in their policy positions on that.
Right.
The current provincial government has done some good work around the disability community.
Yeah.
But that's almost like saying, well, this part of the low-income group, well, they're the deserving poor.
Yeah.
And the rest, well, you know. So Saskatchewan is one of the, I think there's only two jurisdictions in all of Canada that does not have an anti-poverty, a comprehensive, integrated, strategic anti-poverty plan. Almost every other province has gone in that direction.
And, you know, going back to a point that you made earlier, you're going to save money in different areas if your people or your workers are making more money. You're going to save money in healthcare and things like that. So it's money well spent.
Absolutely, absolutely. The investment in early childhood development, you know, the long-term investment, there's been so many studies that show the benefits of that. And we're kind of slow to get to the table on that particular policy. You know, we are expanding seats. We are expanding kindergarten, early kindergarten, but it's a little bit on the slow side, and it's a little uncoordinated, I would say, across the health districts, the health regional health authorities, and our school boards, and our provincial Department of Education.
And we were just discussing earlier too how the Department of Education and the school boards are paying attention though to this early childhood development topic, and we actually have people out in the field whose job is to make sure that kids are ready for kindergarten when
absolutely.
They hit kindergarten.
So. Absolutely, that has started to happen in a much more structured way in the last decade, but I think it's still the issue around resources are not significantly applied to really provide equitable child care, equitable early childhood opportunities for all families in the province.
So it's a start, but they can
do
better.
I think so.
Right. Now, there's always there are always people who argue against paying more. Somehow it's going to cut the number of jobs, things like that. Was that something that the study looked at as well, and whether it would have a negative effect on business?
Well, we made some arguments that it would not increase unemployment. And I believe that argument was based on the research that was done on minimum wage. Mm-hmm. You know, the attacks on minimum wage was often, well, it was going to be a job killer.
Right.
But if you compare the benefits to the numbers of jobs lost,
right,
the benefits outweigh it. And, and we argue that unemployment would not be increased significantly by paying a living wage. And we've cited a couple of studies in our study along those lines. For municipalities to bring in a bylaw, asking their contractors to bid on any tender on the basis of a living wage, sometimes the municipalities have argued, well, we can't afford to adopt that.
Sometimes they can't afford not to.
Exactly. if you want to get the best contractor out there to do the quality work, right?
And that goes back to what we were talking about before, where if you don't want to have turnover. The turnover in your employees costs you money.
Yes.
It costs you a lot of money in terms of recruitment and training and all that stuff. So the savings by not paying people a living wage are really not there when it comes right down to it. The reverse is true. Mm-hmm.
Well, we were arguing that a living wage bylaw has an effect of sort of leveling the playing field for all of the folks who want a contract, so that the contractors then compete on the same basis on trying to get the best productivity, the best service quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this goes back to, I guess, this has been a complaint with, I don't know whether it's the way, I should be better versed in this, but I'm not, but like what you're saying, you'll have, an out-of-province contractor come in to do a job, and he's bringing people in with him, but they're not making that much money, or they hire people that they're not willing to pay an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at it, these people they're not going to stay here, you know, and they're not going to keep those employees either.
Right. It's the commitment, the two-way commitment that you're more likely to get if the employee is treated fairly related to their wage.
Oh, let's see. I'm just quickly looking at this contingency fee.
Part of the contingency part of the budget?
Yeah.
Yes.
$2,000 and a little over, $2,304 is what you have in your study. What sort of things would that cover? Why would they have that? That's not savings.
No, we did some work with some low income people that we had some discussions around, you know, what issues that they were facing, and they raised this whole business of contingency often.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said was a lot of these low-income jobs are not very secure. You know, some people are calling they're contingent jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're precarious. The hours can fluctuate by 1 month, lots is happening, they get full hours, the next month they lose 15 or 20% of their hours, therefore their income.
Awfully hard to run a family when you don't know what's coming in for money.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was one of the things, reasons why we built in contingency. Mm-hmm. The other one was for costs related to grandparents, taking care of parents who may be ill, maybe they live out of town, maybe you have to drive out there, pick them up, bring them to the city, cost of transportation, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's the people that we talked to mentioned five or six of these these issues that come up within families that acts increases their cost of living.
Right.
And so we built in this contingency piece then to cover that, knowing that it happens in every family.
Yeah, and when you think about it, there are, if it's income tax time here now, and there are things that in your income tax form that if you have a situation where you're looking after your parents or somebody is disabled, they do take that into consideration.
Yes, they pass these sort of boutique little niche tax deductions, you know, like if you buy sports equipment for your children, you get a $75. I don't know exactly what it is, but the federal government has come up with a whole bunch of these little special tax deductions. But it's interesting for our family, Jim, when we said expenses equals employment income plus government transfers, the government transfers for our family amounted to $4,343. That's how much they could get on these tax breaks and any other supports. However, at this income level, they would pay $6,342 in taxes. So the supports compared to the taxes, they're paying out $2,000 more almost than they are
getting
in supports.
Brian, I was just thinking here, I'm going to take a quantum leap. We're talking about all these complexities and programs and all the rest of it. I wonder if we haven't come to the time, and we're getting towards the end of our time here now. Is this the time now for governments to start thinking about a negative income tax? Wouldn't that solve problems an awful lot more simply?
There's some people are really, really in favor of that. There's critics of it. Some people say that it doesn't really attack the long-term redistribution problem. As our society has evolved, inequality has become more and more and more serious. And inequality has some severe costs. If you'd like, I could just quote a little bit from Gordon Thurborn.
We got about 30 seconds.
30 seconds? He says, inequality is a violation of human dignity. It is the denial of the possibility for everybody's human capabilities to develop. It takes many forms. Premature death, ill health, humiliation, subjection, discrimination, exclusion from knowledge, or from mainstream social life, poverty, powerlessness, stress, insecurity, anxiety, lack of self-confidence, and of pride in oneself. And I could go on.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate you being here, and that's a great way to end up the program.
Thank you.
And we're out of time. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."